Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Okay, everybody, this is Aaron Weinacht, and today we're going to talk to John Hajduk about his new book, Music Wars. John's a colleague of mine here at University of Montana Western, and he's also a first-class individual. So, John Hajduk, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
You bet. You want to start us off by telling us something about yourself? A little bio would be good.
Okay, yeah, as you know, I was born and raised in Western New York, went to school at the University of Buffalo, got a PhD there in American cultural history. And I've been here at the University of Montana Western for 21 years in December, and have enjoyed mostly the time here teaching and working in our block system, our unique block system.
Okay. Now, I was wondering if you could kind of tell us a bit about how you came to write the book overall. Like, what was the background on it?
Well, in many ways, it's a dramatic revision of my PhD dissertation. The story behind this actually goes back to when I first started graduate school. I was looking for a part-time job, and I found a position at a record store in Buffalo, New York, a place called Record Theater, which billed itself as the largest record store in the world. I never knew if that was actually true, but it was a pretty big place. And I worked there all throughout graduate school, and I was very interested in music. I'd always been a fan. But being involved in the store, I was exposed to more of a behind-the-scenes part of the music industry. And eventually, I was the assistant to the buyer, and things would pop up, relations with record labels. We serviced some radio stations. So I got a little bit of a broad view of the music industry, and it fascinated me. So I was studying history and working this part-time job on the side, and I thought I'd try and find a way to combine the two. And this initially occurred in the context of a seminar. I wrote a couple of papers about licensing, music licensing, and it just kept building. So when it came time to choose a thesis topic, I thought I could do something on that. So the PhD dissertation was constructed around a series of disputes that occurred within the popular music industry back in the 1940s and 1950s. And at that time, being a graduate student, the dissertation ended up being filled with lots of theory that I stuck in there to try and impress my professors. And frankly, it was a great project. I enjoyed working on it. But in the end, I had this monstrosity that had a lot more extraneous information than was probably necessary. So after a number of years went by, I did some other things, did some research in other areas. I just kept going back to the narrative, the story that sort of informed the dissertation, and thought I could do a much cleaner and much more concise version of that story by basically stripping out all of the theory that I felt obligated to include as a dissertation.
Well, of course, if it got you to pass your dissertation, John, you know, we can't really say that it wasn't necessary, can we?
Well, no, I guess that's true. I mean, it was there for a reason, and I'm proud of the dissertation. I don't mean to in any way demean it, but as you know, after you've done something like that, you're looking for other ways to kind of maybe this is an unfortunate word, but to exploit that. I mean, I hoped I could publish the dissertation, and that proved to be a struggle. I mined it for a couple of articles, and that was fine. But more and more, as I say, it just struck me as something a little bit more unwieldy than it needed to be. And so about 6 years ago, I was able to get a sabbatical, and I spent 6 months going back over the same essential narrative following that same series of disputes, minus the chapter that ended up being turned into articles, but looking at it with a fresh focus. Initially, the dissertation was all about accommodation and how minority groups and disaffected Southerners and so forth were integrated into the mainstream of popular culture, and that was still kind of an ongoing theme with the revision. But in the new version, I tried to tell the story a little bit more plainly and lay out the details of what was happening on more or less on the human scale, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And again, trying to not have it be buried in jargon and terminology that I think in a way kind of distracted from the inherent drama of what I wanted to say. I guess I should lay out my thesis for you, through this series of disputes, the groups that were not artists and not the audience for popular music had a role to play in shaping how the music evolved, and that in relation to rock and roll in particular, that occurred because during each of these disputes, the gatekeepers, the record company executives, the radio networks, the licensing organizations, the musicians union. During these disputes, which almost always originated over money, they employed rhetoric. They employed terms for public consumption in which they argued that this music is more important. It's more significant than just entertainment. And I think that was something that the younger generation who embraced rock and roll at the end of the 1950s kind of picked up on, that that the music was something more than just an opportunity to go out and dance. And that becomes really evident, I think, in the 1960s, which was a little bit beyond the scope of the story that I told. But I wanted to focus on how those aspects of the business side of the equation, as opposed to the artistic side of the equation, contributed to building that mindset that popular music in general was something that had more import than just being a diversion, something you did on Saturday night.
Right. I had actually a question on that. Well, sorry, I'm getting some feedback here, but I had a question about something you said in your introduction, kind of along those same lines. As I read your introduction, it seemed to indicate that you think that rock and roll has kind of made the world we live in, as opposed to, you know, kind of describing it. So given what you said about how, you know, business influences and so on, how those affected or, you know, the rock and roll's development, like, you know, can you comment at all at this point on how rock and roll kind of made our world versus being made by it?
Sure. And actually that's one of the first things that I tried to set up in the book, that there's something that we can identify as rock and roll culture, which is related to the music, but isn't strictly about the music, that it involves a way of looking at the world that is a little bit more open with regard to issues like civil rights, to issues related to sex and sexual identity, related to social causes, group identity. And this filters out in, you know, sort of straight political activism by the 1960s and 70s, but also in things like fashion, that people embrace music that will serve as a major factor in defining their identity, their sense of who they are, and how that plays out in just about every walk of life. And I really believe that was something that was evident in what, you know, is commonly referred to as the baby boomer generation, coming of age in the at the end of the 50s and into the 1960s. I'd probably say that that while it had a major impact on shaping life, in, at least in the United States, in the latter decades of the 20th century, I'm not sure if I had to make the claim that it continues to have that, carry that same weight and have that same influence today. I'm not sure that I could make that case as strongly. So I think it's something that shapes the late 20th century, but maybe something that started to fade as the next several generations have passed and maybe embraced other means of defining who they are. But for that period, again, beginning at the end of the 1950s and through the end of the 20th century, you see rock and roll just being integrated into so many different aspects of life. And I don't think that would have happened if that first wave of fans hadn't sensed that there was something more to this music than just something that, you know, was a passing fancy. When you see the emergence again in the, more in the 60s, I suppose, of artists like Bob Dylan and the Beatles and many, many others, it becomes pretty clear that they have internalized that notion that if they have something to say and they want it to be taken seriously, that they can make that statement through their music.
You know, I graduated from high school in 96, John, and a lot of the cliques in my high school were music based.
Sure.
I mean, I ran with the metalheads, just in case any, you know, you're curious. My spine still hasn't recovered from the head banging, I don't think. I don't know where you went to high school. Were their cliques kind of based on musical tastes?
Yeah. Oh, there definitely was. But I'm a little older than you, so there was the disco clique, and there were metalheads. I don't think punk had quite infiltrated my school. Although I remember one girl who came in one day with a very bizarre haircut for our crowd. And she was, she was probably the one person who had embraced punk in the late 70s. I was more of a jazzbo. And I'm not sure if that was a very large clique, but there were two or three of us who decided that all pop music was crummy, and so we were looking for alternatives in jazz.
Well, I mean, seriously though, according to the, you know, how I read your book, and where it gets to the questions about authenticity, now and then, I mean, the smaller your clique is, probably you can argue the more authentic it is, right?
Exactly. And I think that was something that, that again, helped to define somebody's sense of identity, that authenticity, however you define the authenticity, it was clear that you had to be real. You had to be, authentic in order to have any kind of credibility with your peers.
Is there anything you'd want to say, that you haven't about kind of the overall focus of the book from the introduction?
Well, again, I'd emphasize that, there have been dozens of really good histories of the early days of rock and roll. And although my title, the subtitle anyway, includes that idea of rock and roll, my focus isn't really ultimately on the music so much as the way that people talked about the music. And again, with a special emphasis on the people who are in positions of authority or power. The disputes, just to make it a little bit clearer, that I look at start with the ASCAP radio ban of 1940. That was ASCAP is the American American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. It's a licensing organization whose roots go back to the years right around World War I. And they were a very dominant force, and they collected royalties from anybody who used popular music, or anyway, popular music written or published by its members, ASCAP members, and they would then distribute those to their clients. they carried a lot of weight. They had contracts with radio broadcasters that were very favorable to ASCAP. And in 1940, they decided, given how much clout they had, that they would up the ante and ask for more money. And the broadcasters rebelled. The consequence of that was that the ASCAP-controlled music, which was virtually all the most popular stuff, if you're familiar with pop music of that generation, material written by people like Cole Porter and Jerome Kern and Irving Berlin, was all controlled by ASCAP. So when the broadcasters said that they wouldn't broadcast that anymore, that was a big hole in what people expected in terms of popular music. Anyway, I seem to be going into more detail. Actually, this is the next chapter, really. But that was the first dispute. The second one was the American Federation of Musicians ban on recording during World War II. I look at the Red Scare in the music industry, and then the evolution of network and local radio in the 1950s, and the rise of disc jockeys, which created its own little hullabaloo, and then finish up with the with the payola scandals of 1959 and 1960. So each of those in sequence and by themselves are an interesting story, and they comprise the chapters of the book. The thing that links them together is that, again, in each of those instances, there's almost always an economic argument being made between the various figures within the industry. But when they take those battles to the public, they almost always translate it into, this is why this music is important. This is why this music is patriotic. This is why this music needs to be protected and preserved. And as I say, those are the factors that I think eventually register with the younger generation when they embrace a music that isn't approved by groups like ASCAP. Well, they have a ready argument to make why it's significant, because ASCAP has provided them with that rhetoric.
I was curious on your first chapter there, kind of, so you just gave us a nice overview there of each chapter in succession and what ties them together. But then back to your first chapter, you mentioned in there that the music industry was fairly standardized about 1940. I think that was the word you used. I was wondering if you could elaborate on what range of factors made it that way.
Sure. Well, things were controlled by a relatively small number of companies. You had several major recording companies. You had three major radio networks, which broadcast an awful lot of music. And not too surprisingly, they favored music by the recording companies that they actually shared an interest in, ownership interest. And then there were the licensing groups. Well, really only one at that time, which was ASCAP, which represented publishers. So you had music publishers, recording companies, and broadcasters, and they were very well integrated. This was actually something that was a fairly recent development. Like a lot of industries, things were kind of, you know, Wild West in the 19th century in this regard. And of course, that's even before radio was around. But as things evolved into the 1920s and especially into the 1930s, there was consolidation. And the consolidation led to a kind of monolithic view of what the public wanted. And what they wanted from the industry perspective was what the industry was prepared to give them, because it provided profits back to the industry. So you had marginalized styles of music like what was called hillbilly at the time, or country music today, or ethnic music, blues music. These were styles that were performed and popular among certain segments of the population, but within the monolithic popular music industry, they were mostly ignored. They didn't have a place, partly because those large companies didn't control the copyrights on those songs. They didn't control the performers. And so going from the 20s into the 1930s, that music virtually disappears from the mass mentality. Again, there are pockets, regional places where you could certainly find any kind of music. But on those large purveyors of mass entertainment, they were virtually invisible. And so that led to standardization. They would play things that they thought were inoffensive, maybe especially with regard to radio, who, of course, had to curry favor with advertisers. They didn't want to alienate anybody. So
Do you get the impression that the people on the whole were happy with that? I mean, is there kind of enough of a common set of tastes that few people are really demanding anything else? I mean, are people, they don't get to hear about Robert Johnson's deal with the devil, but they want to?
That's it. It comes down to exposure. Because it was such a closed system, at least for the better part of 20 years, the public didn't necessarily know that there was other stuff out there. Okay. Those who did often embraced it. There are lots of great stories about jazz fans who would hear one thing and decide there's got to be more of this out there and literally go knocking on the doors in poor black neighborhoods asking people if they had any old 78s and sort of rescuing this music that had otherwise been forgotten, and not necessarily having a place to expose it, but collecting those things and making them available years later when people started asking those questions again. Where did this stuff come from? And a lot of that's associated with rock and roll because, as you know, talking about heavy metal, somebody like Jimmy Page certainly was well versed in those classic country blues.
Oh, certainly.
And he was exposed to that because collectors had managed to preserve those things for the few years where they were hard to come by. And then by the end of the 50s, early 60s, they started to reappear.
Well, John Paul Jones, his bass style came straight from James Jamerson out of Motown.
Right.
Roots and so on.
Mm-hmm. I think that when people were exposed to these other styles of music, they often leapt at them. They loved it. During that ASCAP band that I mentioned, when you couldn't hear compositions by Cole Porter on the radio because ASCAP said, we're not going to let you have our music if you don't pay our fees, the radio stations had to scramble and fill in the time with something else. And although this is often exaggerated in some of the more other standard histories, one of the things they did was look for music that was not covered by ASCAP, and that meant things like country and blues. And although it took a while for that really to take off, once somebody heard Pistol Packin' Mama by Al Dexter, which was the first sort of giant country hit post ASCAP, it was a phenomenon. And before you knew it, there were all kinds of other country artists, because once people were exposed, they found that they did like it. They just needed to know it was out there before they could search it out.
Well, in my old rock band, we once assuaged a pretty ugly looking bar crowd by pulling out Hank Williams' No Teardrops Tonight. So right? I can attest that still works.
Sure. The thing is that, and I've been talking about the broadcasters primarily, but the record companies operated kind of the same way. They even though they recorded multiple styles of music, there was a built-in assumption that certain people weren't interested in certain kinds of music. So they would record blues artists, but then they would only market those in communities where there were substantial African-American populations. So if you live in a place like Dillon, Montana, there would not have been any place that you could buy or order a blues record, just because the record companies would not assume that anybody in Dillon, Montana wanted to hear that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I can see that. I remember a guy when I was in college asking me what I was listening to, and I told him I was listening to some blues of some kind. I don't remember what specifically, but he said, "How come you're listening to that black music?"
Really?
And yeah, that was in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
No, it's those old attitudes kind of die hard. I don't know.
Yeah. And, different people have different tastes, and there's nothing wrong with that. Not everybody likes everything. But again, I think more often than not, when you're exposed to something new, there's a good chance that it's going to speak to you, or it's just going to move your feet, get you want to get up and dance and stuff that you become enthusiastic really quick.
Well, certainly. Yeah, if you can keep your toe from tapping when listening to Robert Johnson, you're better than me.
Yeah.
So I'm curious then, I'm thinking here of what's in the second chapter of the book, John, about could you maybe elaborate a little bit on how what amounts to an economic feud between artists and managers ultimately contributes to cultural change? Like how a predominantly economic argument somehow morphs into some much broader cultural shift?
Sure. And I'll give you an example from the AFM band, the American Federation of Musicians. They were headed up by a guy named James C. Petrillo, who was kind of a little tin pot dictator over his domain, which was the Musicians Union back in the 1940s. And one of the big technological breakthroughs of that period was the arrival of jukeboxes. And so a lot of venues, nightclubs, bars, restaurants, whatever, were putting jukeboxes into their facilities and stocking them with records. And so you could go in and you'd be out for dinner and you could put a nickel in and listen to a song that you enjoyed. Well, the Musicians Union got up in arms about this because many of those same venues had previously employed live musicians. And with the installation of these machines, the live musicians lost their jobs. So James C. Petrillo, the head of the union, decided that something had to be done. And in 1943, again, the union had contracts with recording companies. They tried to work with the recording companies to get them to stop stocking the jukeboxes. They refused because that was a moneymaker for them. And so the union decided to end all of its contracts. They would not allow union musicians to record. And if you were a member of the AFM, you were banned from going into a recording studio and making records for the better part of 2 years. The upshot of this was that there was still a demand for records by the jukebox operators, by consumers in the home. They still wanted to listen to music, but they couldn't buy music that was performed by members of the union, which amounted to all of the most popular big band leaders, for example, that time, the swing era. So what happens? The record companies have to come up with something new. This is, by the way, where Frank Sinatra first exploded, because they would bring Frank Sinatra in. He was a big band singer, but vocalists were not members of the union. So they'd bring him into the recording studio and he'd record a cappella or maybe with some backing singers. And those were some of his first big hits as a solo artist because it didn't require any union musicians. But more to the point, to answer the question, several small record labels began to pop up to service the demand. They didn't have any contracts with the union to begin with, but it didn't matter because they sought out music that also was not covered by the Musicians Union. And this was another big impetus for country music and blues, because the union, first of all, it was segregated. It didn't invite black membership. There were a few places like New York and Los Angeles where there was a significant number of African-American musicians that they formed segregated locals of the AFM, but that wasn't true everywhere. And blues musicians in particular, who typically only accompanied themselves with a guitar or a harmonica, were not considered to be serious musicians, so the Musicians Union never recruited them. So when these small labels started to pop up to meet the demand, they looked for musicians who were not members of the union, and they introduced large numbers of blues artists and country artists into the mainstream because those records were going into the jukeboxes and, again, through exposure, finding a fan base and exploding. So in terms of the broader culture, people's horizons are expanding in terms of the kind of music that they're listening to. But I think also over time, also maybe building up an appreciation for certain regional distinctions in the ways that people express themselves, the ways that they communicate with one another. I think all of those things start to factor in. The biggest effect of this, to my mind anyway, and this is one of the arguments I make in the book, is that as those trends continue into the 1950s, even long beyond the ban, those small labels continue to market these previously marginalized styles of music, they're embraced by young people. And initially in the form of rhythm and blues, and then eventually evolving into rock and roll. And I think that younger generation, when they listened to this music that was being performed by African-American artists, began to raise serious questions about, I enjoy the music. It speaks to me, makes me want to dance. Why don't I see any of these people in my neighborhood? Why don't I see any of these people in my school? And I can't help but think, and it, there are a lot of perhaps coincidental events that that sort of fuel this conclusion, like the fact that Elvis Presley's first record came out just a couple of months after the Brown decision desegregating schools. But by the time rock and roll is starting to take root, 1955, 1956, I think young people are starting to reject the older notions of racial separation that had largely defined our society up until that point. And I think that an eye-opener for them was this music that they enjoyed and making that association. If I like the music, why am I discriminating against these people in other ways?
Is there specific documentary evidence of that, like in the sources from the civil rights movement, people who were involved in that, like in their memoirs or other reminiscences? Do they indicate
there
that direction?
And it actually kind of, to some degree, I think, comes back to that authenticity too that you had brought up a moment ago, that the way that the record industry was set up, if a record hit by an African-American artist, there was a tendency to cover it with a white artist, that is, have a white artist record the same song in order to cater to the white audience. But it was the youngsters, the teenagers, who rejected that in large measure. They decided they wanted the real thing. And so they sought out the originals in ways that their parents hadn't, because that was a trend that of covering records that went back for several decades. But in the 1950s, the audience wanted the real thing, the young audience anyway. But you see that all the time in accounts by individuals who were active in the civil rights movement. By the 1960s, it becomes prevalent. I mean, you see the artists, again, Bob Dylan, I guess, is the classic example, or somebody like Joan Baez or Phil Oakes. And they're maybe coming more out of a folk music side of things, but they're embracing eventually also rock styles. Artists, you mentioned Motown. A lot of the songs that Motown put out were not intended to be civil rights anthems, but were embraced by the civil rights movement, and individuals who are active going out and demonstrating and marching would talk about that. Dancing in the Street is maybe the example. There's a really good book by a guy named Mark Kurlansky that talks about dancing in the street as representative of that tendency.
That's I was curious too, John. I'm kind of moving on here to your third chapter, so you can summarize if you want. I'm curious though, when I read that you're talking about canned music, and this also kind of relates to the authenticity theme. I was kind of wondering if people viewed becoming a professional rock and roller as a bit of a devil's bargain. And that, once you've recorded, it's there, right? It's not changeable anymore. It doesn't evolve like, traditional music that you play on the back porch and add things to and subtract other things from it and so on.
Right.
So I was wondering if there's any of that dynamic among people who are playing music where, like, by recording, are you selling out? Or because that would be another way to look at, you'd be looking at recording in the opposite direction from the way you cast it earlier.
It's an interesting dynamic in this whole story, because on the one hand, I'm kind of making the case that the music was something more than just this this entertainment commodity. But on the other hand, it was a commodity. That's one of the features of rock music, maybe more prevalent than earlier forms of popular music, at least in this country, that it was mostly associated with recordings. But that's not to say there obviously wasn't live performance as well, but the live performance of early rock and roll artists typically was one or two songs. They'd be on a package tour with 8 or 10 different artists. They'd all get up and play 3 or 4 songs, basically their singles. So it was always directly linked to the record. And, to be honest, I'm sure that the artists, however much they wanted to express themselves, also wanted to make a living. So that commodity feature never goes away. It's always there. How that affects the authenticity? Well, I think, again, it goes back to getting the more raw, unvarnished version of, well, whatever the song is, that you'd listen, you'd want to hear Fats Domino's Walking to New Orleans, or I'm Walking instead of Ricky Nelson's version, or you'd want to hear Tutti Frutti by Little Richard instead of Pat Boone. And the authenticity was in the grooves. It was in the record as much as in a more less commercial enterprise.
Okay. Is there anything else you wanted to say at this point or elaborate on what's in your third chapter there about, canned and recorded music?
Well, the canned music, that refers directly to the jukeboxes. That was the term that was used by Petrillo to complain about the jukeboxes. And in that regard, maybe I should just say something about the band. There were a couple of interesting features to this that sort of fueled, again, the rhetoric that was used during the dispute. It was primarily an economic dispute. The union wanted to protect the jobs of its members, and the jukebox operators and the record companies, more specifically, wanted to have cheap entertainment and make money off the nickels going into the jukebox. So it was really about dollars and cents in a lot of ways, but it happened against the backdrop of World War II. During World War II, virtually every union labor organization in the country promised they would not go on strike and they'd contribute to the war effort. And the musicians' union, Petrillo, had made a pledge directly to Franklin Roosevelt saying, "Don't worry, the musicians are here to help build morale and do everything we can to pitch in, help win the war." So when the band came, it was seen as a real violation of that pledge, of that promise. And that fueled the rhetoric. The union was being unpatriotic. The union wasn't contributing to the war effort. The union was, undermining our fighting force by not providing them with moments entertainment when they came off the front line, or the defense workers when they got off their shift were being deprived of something. And it was something that that Petrillo had to address. And one way that they addressed it was they continued to make recordings that were sent directly into the armed forces so that they would have records to play in their off hours. But as I say, that contributed to the nature of the debate. It wasn't your typical labor stoppage. It was something that seemed to have an impact, or anyway was perceived to have an impact, on whether or not we were going to win the war.
So there's a real irony there then that, since we tend to associate rock and roll in the 60s and 70s so much with the anti-war movement,
that's
that some of its background ultimately goes back to the practice of total war.
No, that's true. Although I don't know that you'd have too many people quite yet in 1943 talking about rock and roll.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm overstating.
Well, but the roots are there. And again, that's part of what I was trying to demonstrate, was that the perception of how music can be something more than just entertainment is already evident in these debates, which really, for the most part, revolve around what we call big band or swing music more than anything else, because those were the most popular groups at that time.
So on to your next chapter there, where you're talking about the Red Scare and, right, and the music industry. I'm just going to give us an overview here of how those two things are related.
Sure. Well, there are two things that I try and establish in that chapter. The first is that, unlike the movie industry, the record industry was starting to fragment already by the late 1940s, partly as a result of the earlier disputes, the rise of independent record labels being one of the consequences of those earlier disputes, and the introduction into the mainstream of those previously marginalized styles of music. So the music industry had ceased to be quite that powerful monolith that dominated the 1930s. And so when people began to throw accusations around of individuals who were communists or fellow travelers or whatever, sympathetic to left-wing causes, inevitably there were a large number of musicians who were subject to those accusations. But unlike the movie industry, Hollywood, though, it was very difficult to do anything about that because there was no central authority anymore. Certainly artists found their records banned or lost recording contracts, but there was always somebody else available to put you on stage or to open up their studios to you because these independent record labels didn't really care about those political charges. So that was one of the points I want to make. It's this idea of fragmentation in the industry that that was a major factor in the arrival of rock and roll too. But the other side of that is, again, going back to that idea of the rhetoric that was employed, how people argued about the role that music had in the context of trying to preserve these Native American values of democracy and freedom and equality in opposition to what communism represented in that time frame. Which was, totalitarianism and atheism and, all the worst tendencies that were so antithetical to the American way. The irony here is that one of the causes that got caught up in all that was civil rights. You may know this, but the Communist Party in the United States had long sought to integrate themselves into African-American communities, figuring that black folk were going to be pretty dissatisfied with the American system and be willing converts. And although that wasn't true, at least not in any significant way, it did create an impression that communists were pro-civil rights. And so in the era of the Red Scare, anybody who was pro-civil rights was ipso facto sympathetic to communism. So as you saw these new styles of music emerging, rhythm and blues being the most prominent and the most direct link to rock and roll a little bit later, it didn't need to have any political content for it to be suspect. It didn't need to, overtly address issues of nuclear proliferation or anything like that for somebody to be suspicious if the artist was African American. And there were a number of artists, the most famous of which was probably Paul Robeson, but some others like Josh White and Hazel Scott, who actually did often appear at political rallies, who would raise money for different civil rights organizations like the Congress on Racial Equality or the NAACP. And as a consequence of those activities, they were put on lists as being sympathetic to communism, and they had to defend themselves. One of the most popular groups in the early 1950s was the Weavers, which was a folk vocal outfit. Pete Seeger was a member, along with Lee Hayes and Fred Hellerman and Ronnie Gilbert. And some of them, including Seeger and Hayes, definitely had roots in the Communist Party. They'd been members in the 1940s and been active in radical circles. But they had in a sense, cleaned up their act, so to speak, and started making some really, really popular records. Good Night Irene and Tazina Tazina and big, big hits until somebody discovered their background and they lost their recording contract and were blacklisted. But they're kind of the exception. It was really hard to blacklist people in the music industry because, as I say, there were all kinds of other outlets that were open to them to continue working, even if they weren't reaching the mass audience that they had previously had.
So would it be fair to say then that the reprisals against musicians don't take the same character as reprisals against suspected communists in Hollywood simply because it's right. Easier to make music than movies?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Because the industry wasn't quite as consolidated as Hollywood was at that time. So you couldn't, if one company decided they didn't want to have something to do with an artist, there was no guarantee the next company over wouldn't snap them up.
I recall you mentioning that you characterized the Red Scare as ultimately being about a fear of difference or fear of diversity was, I think, the word you used. So I was wondering then if you kind of see the contemporary argument from people who were in favor of attacks on people deemed to be red, as they said at the time. But I mean, do you think that those people were being fundamentally cynical or dishonest?
I think a lot of times they were. Right. I think that the classic example of that, I guess, is somebody like Joseph McCarthy, who pretty clearly was doing what he did to score political points and just attain a degree of power. And I think that the concern, you know, this is where the commerce and the art kind of intersects again, because the concern was that if there's an impression out there that audiences don't want to hear an artist who is suspect, that they also won't buy the products being advertised on the radio program that plays that music, or they'll identify that artist with the label on the record that he's put out, and they won't buy anything else, regardless of the artist, from that label. That whole guilt by association, that was the assumption. I don't know if there's anything that actually backs up that's the way that people behaved, but that was the assumption. We're not going to alienate anybody. We're not going to give them any reason to not want our product or the product of our advertisers. And in this regard, I mean, the advertisers carried a lot of weight. They didn't want to be associated with something that might lead to suspicion of their products or what they were trying to sell. And so that's where the commercial kicks in. In order to protect what you see as a valuable market, you're willing to make sacrifices and other areas, including maybe the quality or the popularity of the performers that you're using to sell those products.
So in a funny way, then, the pressure to make money on the one hand results in more standardization, but in other ways, it also results in less of it, as the overall thrust of your book suggests.
Well, yes and no. I think standardization works as long as people aren't exposed to what's different. Once they are exposed to what's different, there's a demand for that, then that becomes exploitable too. But it's exploited as a niche rather than as a mass market. And I think this is one of the things that, again, from the commercial viewpoint, that becomes evident with those early days of R&B and then into rock and roll, that a small independent company could continue to function without selling millions of records. I mean, if you only press 1,000, but you sell all 1,000, you're in a position to make a profit. You're not going to get fabulously wealthy, but you can run a business that way. And I think more and more operators of these companies, and that in addition to record labels, these would be also apply to smaller radio stations, they would realize we don't need to court the mass audience. We don't have to make millions of dollars. We can maintain a nice, comfortable living by just servicing the people whose tastes correspond with, you know, what we're offering.
Next subject in the book there, you're talking a bit about rock and roll as kind of anti-authority.
Right.
You've got, you know, Yakety Yak, Don't Talk Back, which is a very nice chapter title. I got a chuckle out of that.
Classic coaster song, of course.
I was wondering, John, to what extent do you think that what's being discussed here is rebellion against specific social or cultural conventions versus rebellion against authority as such? I mean, those, they may have the similar results, but, you know, ultimately they're two kind of different things.
Yeah. I think it starts off as just young people wanting to have fun. And I'm not sure if that's necessarily rebellious, but I think that it does feed into the opposition. The older generation trying to crack down and say this music is unacceptable. And at that point, the kids kind of wonder, why is it unacceptable? And when the parents and the older generation can't make a viable case, well, this exposes a degree of hypocrisy that ultimately goes beyond the music. And again, in the area of civil rights, for example, or in the area of sex, obviously kids driven by hormones don't need to be introduced through music to their natural impulses. But when parents are complaining that the music is inflaming their passions, it gives the kids a reason to embrace it. And so it's something that allows them to express that rebellion or express their rejection of what they see as the hypocritical views of their parents in relation to these issues or these behaviors. And that starts, it builds on itself. What starts off as fun becomes a way to tick off your parents. It becomes a way to actually express yourself and assert a position in relation to society that establishes an identity for yourself.
And so authority maybe becomes less plausible gradually or incrementally over time.
Right.
Then
once you're able to raise one question about what we might call the establishment line, inevitably somebody's going to raise questions about the rest of that line. And again, to me, this is most apparent in the area of civil rights. The great story that I tell classes and I include in the book is throughout the country, when rock and roll first starts to become popular, there were these package shows that I mentioned earlier. So you'd have groups of 5, 6, 8 different recording artists going on tour and each getting up and performing 3 or 4 songs or big hits. Often those bills were mixed. There'd be white artists and black artists. And the audience often was also mixed. But in virtually every part of the country, there were some exceptions, but most parts of the country, the venues, which typically were theaters, often movie theaters, were segregated, whether by law in the South or by practice in the North. The white kids and black kids were separated in the venue. If it was someplace with a dance floor, there often would be a rope stretched across the floor or maybe chairs lined up in the middle. And the white kids were supposed to stay on their side, the black kids on their side. And then the music would start. And before you knew it, the rope was gone. The chairs were gone. And kids were dancing amongst each other indiscriminately.
A story.
And that outraged parents. This was at the heart of, I think, their objection to rock and roll was the what they saw as the danger of race mixing. And it played out over and over again. And as I say, kids dancing together, not seeing anything wrong with that, when the parents objected to it, I think inevitably it raised the question, why? Maybe this would be more prevalent in those northern communities where that segregation certainly existed, again, if not by law, then in practice. Why is this such a big deal? I'm just having a good time. And I think that just opens the door to starting to think about, you know, other elements of society.
I was wondering, John, if you could comment on one more thing here in your last chapter of the book, and that was for the listeners here. Could you go into some detail on what exactly payola was?
Sure. Payola is a term that was probably coined by writers of Variety because they made up interesting terms for almost everything that they wrote about. Payola is paying to promote music, songs. It has a long history in the music industry going back at least to the mid-19th century, where music publishers would hire singers to go stand on a corner and sing a song in the hopes that they would entice people to go into the shop and buy the sheet music. And then, of course, over time it evolved. When records came along, artists were hired by publishers to record their songs because they derived royalties from the sale of that music. When radio came along, pluggers, as they were referred to, would go into radio stations and ask that the music that they represented be promoted, be played, and they'd offer inducements. They'd, you know, slip the program director a $10 bill or whatever it might be. It was a widespread practice. It had existed for 100 years. It was not illegal. It was just seen as part of the cost of doing business. But it was something that the wider public was largely ignorant of. They had no idea that that was the way the business worked. So when rock and roll became really, really big by 1957, 1958, and the protests against it based on racial reasons or sex reasons, or there were even charges that it was a communist plot, none of that really took root. The powers that be, including ASCAP, our old friends ASCAP, decided to charge that the only reason that rock and roll was being played on the radio was because the records companies that made rock and roll, and these were mostly small independent companies, were bribing the disc jockeys to play it. And they raised a big stink about this. It led to a congressional investigation during which a number of very famous figures were brought to testify. Alan Freed, the disc jockey, who's largely credited with coining the term rock and roll, at least in relation to this style of music, ended up losing his job because he refused to denounce the practice of payola, which he was almost certainly guilty of. But as I say, it wasn't illegal and it was common practice for just about everybody. Dick Clark also was called to testify. This was early in his career. He was already the host of American Bandstand. And he basically testified that he was just a businessman doing what any businessman would do. And he kind of got off the hook. Apparently the members of Congress kind of appreciated that take as opposed to Freed being more defiant. Anyway, in the end, this was seen as a death blow to rock and roll. The assumption was that Congress and individual states started to pass laws making payola illegal. A lot of the disc jockeys that were associated with the rise of rock and roll had lost their jobs because they'd engaged in accepting payola. Interestingly, the companies that were actually paying the payola didn't suffer any consequences, except maybe the loss of some of these venues for their music. The whole thing kind of blew over. As I say, it was supposed to be the death knell, and it did kind of represent a bit of a setback. But within a couple of years, rock and roll bounces back. You couldn't keep it down. It was what I think the young audience wanted. And so despite those efforts at the highest levels of government, payola didn't go away. It actually, in the 1970s, new laws were written to make it legal again, as long as radio stations would admit they did it. So you'd play a record and say, by the way, this record has been brought to you by the good graces of such and such record label, which was basically admitting we accepted money to play it.
I was wondering about that. I mean, you know, the Indy 500 is brought to you by Doritos. You know,
sure.
It seems like, well, entrepreneurialism right. At work, really.
Exactly. And it was tried to be, yeah, again, the opponents of rock and roll wanted to paint it as being junk music that was only being played because of these bribes and that it had no, you know, value otherwise. But that was clearly not true. By that point, I think young people had certainly embraced it. And you know, the influence was starting to be felt on that next generation of artists who were going to emerge in the 1960s and take it to a whole other level of significance in American society and culture.
Well, John, we're about out of time here. We got about enough time for one more thought here. And I was wondering, by way of wrapping up, that in your conclusion, you mentioned that you've seen this kind of fusion between sound and meaning. You know, this sound I hear, it means something.
Right. And,
excuse me. So I was wondering, you know, we talk a lot about identity politics now and, you know, civil discourse and things. And I was wondering if that means that ultimately you simply can't appreciate me unless you appreciate pre-Black Album Metallica. You know, does this somehow lead, you know, to identity politics in a kind of negative sense where we actually can't communicate anymore because you don't listen to my music?
I think that's definitely the dangerous or potentially dangerous outcome. I mean, it's possible to embrace that identity so resolutely and so completely that you reject everything else. I don't doubt that that's something that occurs. Even going back to the early 1960s in England, when you had riots between the Teddy Boys and the Mods because they listened to different styles of music, and things got really, really violent. That is the worst tendency of this process, absolutely. But I don't think that music is the only factor there, and I don't think that's the I don't think that that's always the final arbiter of what your identity is. It's an aspect of it, but I would argue that there's a more constructive way to view that trying to understand what somebody listens to, or for that matter, you know, the movies they enjoy, or the TV shows, or the clothes they wear. That if you're willing to engage in a degree of tolerance and try to understand it, that it creates an opening for maybe crossing some of the lines that otherwise separate people.
You're hurting me, yeah. John. You're making me think that maybe I should tolerate people who listen to post Black Album Metallica. you're calling me to, you know, listen to my Better Angels, and it hurts.
Well, the example I would use, I'm convinced. I'm not one of those people who, and of my generation, who says that rap isn't music. I've actually enjoyed a lot of rap and hip hop music over the years, but I also understand it's not music that's meant for me. I don't think the artists intend to speak to me with that style of music more often than not. But that doesn't mean that I can't make an effort to understand what is being said and why that resonates with younger people or people who come from a different background. I think that there's an opportunity there to open some lines of communication. It doesn't mean I have to like the music or they have to like the music that I enjoy, but just understand that that's part of who you are, and or at least an entree into understanding who you are.
Certainly. I mean, I listen to old country all the time, and I've been married for years and my truck isn't broken down, so somehow I can still appreciate that.
So
one more, John. I wonder if you could tell us what you're thinking of working on next in brief here, if you can do it in just a minute or two.
Sure. For a number of years, I've been doing research into political comedy that emerged in the 1950s. So kind of going back to the same general time frame of this book, but looking at comedians and folks like Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce, a little bit later on George Carlin and the Smothers Brothers, and just try and get a sense of how much of an impact they had on shaping political attitudes in that that early 60s period, especially, is what I'm interested in that regard. We'll see where that goes.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Thanks for being with us. And this is a quite an interesting book. You've inspired me to go back and listen to some music I haven't thought of in a long time.
Oh, that's always a positive
thing.
Thank
you. Yeah. All right. You're welcome. We'll sign off here now, John. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.